Good morning, everyone. Let's begin. So we're going to do something a little bit different today. In that, whereas normally we devote ourselves to Tehillim, I figure tomorrow is, of course, January 1st. I don't want to take away from the Yontiv, but it's also Asar B'Teves. And obviously there are certain fast days that grab our attention because of their incredible historical relevance, or grab our attention because of the incredible intensity or severity of their restrictions. But there are other fast days that sometimes fall by the wayside, either because we don't fully understand or appreciate what they're about, or more often than not because they don't come with any significant restrictions, or more often because they're sometimes nestled just in the busyness of day-to-day living. So I figured, because we're meeting today on what we'll call Erev Asara B'Teves, I think it's important for us just to take a little bit of time to understand the nature of this fasting, why it is that we fast, and perhaps what is the avoda? What is our obligation? What is our job? What is it that we're supposed to accomplish over the course of this day? Because there's one thing that's clear. The Mishneh Berurah writes, the Mishneh Berurah is Chafetz Chaim's work of halacha. Chafetz Chaim wrote a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, trying to bring together all the different opinions. So the Mishneh Berurah is not a hashkafic work. It's not a musa work. And so whenever you find that the Chafetz Chaim, the Mishneh Berurah, takes time out to give a little bit of musar about something, so it's clear that something is bothering him. So one of the few times where the Chafetz Chaim gives musar in the Mishneh Berurah happens to be at the end of Chelek Vav. We're in the laws of fast days. And in it, he spends time speaking about Bnei Adam Hametailim B'Ta'anis Tzibur, people who go out and take trips on fast days. So the Mishneh Berurah spends time saying, there are some people that just try to pass the day as quickly as possible. So they do all kinds of things in order to pass the time. The truth is, we've all done this at some point in time in some way, shape, or another. And the Mishneh Berurah takes extensive time decrying this idea. He says, people who think that the goal is just simply to get through the day have fundamentally missed the point of a Tanis Tzibur. Interestingly enough, there's only one fast day on the calendar where the be-all and end-all of the day is fasting, and that is Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is the one and only fast day where if you do nothing else throughout the day, you stay in bed the entire day, but I'm not encouraging that, but you stay in bed the entire day, and you fast throughout the entire day, you have fulfilled the biblical obligation of Yom Kippur. In fact, again, fasting on Yom Kippur is so important that this question comes up every year, where a person says, I want to go to shul, but if I go to shul, my health is going to be compromised, my strength is going to be compromised, so I can eat or drink, less than the shear, but I'd really like to go to shul. Is it better for me to go to shul and eat and drink less than the shear, or to stay home the entire day and not step foot in shul over Yom Kippur, but to fast? And the halacha is fast. Fast, fast, fast. That is the essence of Yom Kippur. But Yom Kippur, in that sense, is a halachic anomaly. That's because by Yom Kippur, the act of fasting itself is part of the way we affect kapara. But that is not the most important part of every other fast day. In fact, again, in my Ma'alot class, I'm teaching them Sefer Yonah, and we're up to the part now where after the city of Nineveh did tshuva. I don't mean to ruin the story for anyone. But the city of Nineveh does tshuva. And interestingly enough, the story of Yonah is used as the paradigmatic example of tshuva. And in fact, what the Navi says is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu saw their sincerity. So the Gemara points out, it doesn't say that God saw their sackcloth, and it doesn't say that God saw their fasting. Rather, it says that God saw their sincerity. God saw their tshuva, that God saw their hearts. So the Chafetz Chaim says that if a person thinks that they observe a fast day, and they haven't eaten from, let's say, dawn until nightfall, that they have fulfilled the avoda of the fast day, but nothing in them has changed, they are fundamentally and profoundly wrong. The entire essence of a fast day is, we'll use the word tshuva. But tshuva, of course, means much more than just repentance. Tshuva ultimately means what? A return. A return. Remember, the word tshuva, Rav Soloveitchik points out that interestingly enough, that tshuva, we find this root by Shmuel HaNavi. So you know, Shmuel HaNavi was, for lack of a better term, like the first what we'll call circuit judge. What did Shmuel HaNavi do? He left his home at the beginning of the year, and he traveled throughout the entire land, throughout the course of the year. And only at the end of the year did he go ahead and make it back home. So the lashon of the Navi is, Uteshuvaso harama. When Shmuel HaNavi would come back to Ramah, which was his home, so Soloveitchik says very poignantly, he says, you know what the essence of tshuva? The essence of tshuva is coming back home. Or the essence of tshuva is coming back to basics. It's not just simply a return to sin, but tshuva really represents a process of introspection, of taking stock, the power of a fast day. It allows us to break our normal rhythms, because what happens in life, as we all know, is we get into our regular life, our living rhythms, and the truth is, rarely do we have time to take a step back, to think, to introspect, to analyze, to figure out, am I going in the right direction, not going in the right direction, do I need some course-correcting activity or not? We're so focused on just the day-to-day regimen that we never break the rhythm. A fast day gives us the opportunity to break the rhythm. I'm not eating, I'm not drinking, which by definition means today is something already a little bit different. But the not eating and not drinking is not an ends. It's a means to be able to take a step back from normal day-to-day living, to think, to introspect, and to reflect. And that's why the Mishnah Berurah, who does not normally give Musar in his Mishnah Berurah, takes the time and says, you know what, if I'm spending the day at the mall, or I'm spending the day at the park, or I'm spending the day just getting my errands done in order to pass the time, chaval, what a loss. What a loss, because how often do you have an opportunity for introspection? How often do you have an opportunity to just think about life? So take advantage of the opportunity, which therefore, by definition, behooves us to understand what it is that we are fasting for tomorrow, and ultimately where we should try to gear our introspection and reflection. So let's begin with number one. So the Shulchan Aruch writes, Chayovim Lis'anos, this is the Shulchan Aruch again in Simin Tav Kuf Mem Tes, which speaks about the laws of fast days. The bulk of this particular section in Shulchan Aruch is devoted to the laws of Tisha B'Av. Because remember again, aside from Yom Kippur, the only other fast day with the greatest amount of restrictions, of course, is Tisha B'Av. But he first goes through all the list of all the fast days. We're obligated to fast on the 9th of Av, Tisha B'Av, Yud Zayin B'Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz, Gimel Tishrei, which is Tzom Gedalia, Uba'asara b'teves, and on the 10th of Teves, why? Mipnei dvarim ha'ro'im she'iru bahem. Because on each of these days, bad things happen. Now, I'll tell you something interesting. In regard to all of the other fast days, the events that unfolded on these days are absolutely clear. So we know on Tisha B'Av, first and second temples are destroyed. 17th of Tammuz, what happens? Right? Walls of Yerushalayim were breached. The Luchos were broken even earlier on. We know what happened there. 3rd of Tishrei, assassination of Gedaliah ben Achikam, which represented the beginning of loss of Jewish autonomy. But then we come to Asara B'Teves. What happened on the 10th of Teves? And here, what's fascinating to see is there are a whole variety of opinions as to why we fast on the 10th of Teves. I'm not going to share with you all of them. I'm just going to share with you. I want to say something for next year. Although Halavai should be a Yom Tov by next year, as we'll discuss. But take a look at number two. There's an amazing Gemara Maseches Megillah. The Gemara says, Desanya, Ma'aseh B'Talmi HaMelech, Shekines Shivim Ushtaim Zekin. There was an episode with King Ptolemy. Who is King Ptolemy? So remember again, historically, there are two Ptolemies. Ptolemy 1, Ptolemy 2. Ptolemy 1 was one of the generals of Alexander the Great. I've mentioned this before. We were in our Hanukkah shir. When Alexander the Great dies, he leaves no heirs, no heirs at all, and his kingdom is divided up by his four strongest generals, one of them by the name of Ptolemy. Ptolemy takes over the entire Middle East region. So King Ptolemy has an idea. What's his idea? He gathered 72 Jewish elders, v'chnisam b'shivim u'shnayim batim, and he put each of the elders in a separate location, v'lo gila lehem amakinsan, and he did not reveal to them why he was collecting them, why he was putting them on almost like house arrest. V'nichnas etzal kol echad v'echad v'amrlam, he went to each of them and he said, kisvuli toras Moshe rabchem. And here is what he charged them with. I want you to write for me just a copy of your Torah. Understand, the Greeks, of course, were very into culture, and the Greeks had an incredible appreciation for other cultures. You know, it's interesting. There are some nations that, when they conquered others, wanted to eradicate any semblance of the conquered culture. The Greeks were not like that. The Greeks were great admirers of culture. So they appreciated what the Jewish people had. They wanted a copy of it. Remember, you see, we live in such a different time that if you want to find Torah, so of course, where do you go? Books. Who goes to a bookstore? Bookstore. Google, right? I'm saying, you know, you go ahead and you Google Torah and Mamish. Again, anything and everything in any language you want. We live in an incredible age of art scroll where you could get Torah in any single language you want, right? You could go to Chabad.org and they have that website in English, in French, in German, in Spanish, anything you want. But remember, once upon a time, if it was not like that, Satomi is eager to get his hands on a copy of the Torah. He wants the Torah. Really what he wants is, he wants to be able to translate the Torah into Greek, but he needs a real authenticated copy of Torah. Now, Talmi's a smart man, and he realizes the following. He must have been smart from the way that he did this. He realized that what's the big problem? What's the big problem with Torah Shebichsav? What's the big problem with the Chamishichum Shetorah, the written law of the Torah? So there are many sections that we know you can't understand without Torah Sheba'al Peh, without the oral tradition. So if you go ahead and you just try to learn Judaism from a Chumash, you're going to come away with many erroneous understandings. Simplest, most well-known one, Ayin Tachas Ayin, right? Reuven knocks out Shimon's eye, so it sounds like biblically, what's the mandated punishment? Right? You knock out Reuven's eye, but of course, no, that's not true. We have the Torah Sheba'al Peh that tells us that Ayin Tachas Ayin actually means financial compensation. Well, Tomi is not interested in any apologetics for Torah. Tomi wants pure, unadulterated Torah. So he realizes that what happens? He gathers 72 of the greatest sages. If you put them all in a room together, what's going to happen? First of all, nothing's going to get done. 72 Jews in one room with one project is going to be a big problem. But more importantly, there's going to be collusion. That what he was afraid of was they're going to say, listen, you know, we can't write this because it's going to be understood like that. So no collusion. So if you separate them, give them each the same task, even if one guy tries to deviate, you have 72 different versions from hopefully which you could glean the purest translation of the text. So what happened? So obviously you understand that this is a very dangerous moment. Because if they give Tomi, and remember, it's not only just halacha, as we're going to see from the examples that are given, there are certain parts of the Torah that if without being understood, you know, it's like lahavdil, you know, they used to have it in the cereal boxes, you know, they have prizes. So you get like this decoder ring, right? So what's the chap with the decoder ring, right? There's a message, and the decoder ring decodes it. So there are certain things in the Torah where when you read them, it doesn't make sense. It just doesn't, when we'll see some examples of that, that's why we have Rashi, we have Torah Sheba, we have Gemara. But again, remember, Talmi's not interested in any supplemental commentaries. Talmi just wants straight text. So an incredible miracle happened. Nasin HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'leiv kol echad ve'echad etza. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave, literally means etza, wisdom counsel to each of the 72 sages, and they all made the same exact changes to their recording of the Torah. The Eskimu Kul Nadasach. You understand the incredible miracle. 72 sages, all separated, and made the same exact changes to the version of the Torah they were giving to Ptolemy. Now the Gemara gives some of the examples of some of the changes. For example, the Kasvulo, Elokim Bara Bereshis. What's the opening pasuk in the Torah? Bereshis Bara Elokim. Now, the truth is, you could very easily, we're a little bit conditioned to translating and saying the psukim in a certain way, but there's a concern. If you're looking at this for the first time, Bereshis Bara Elokim sounds like what? There's this entity called Bereshis, and this entity called Bereshis, the beginning, right? This is the name of this deity, Bara Elokim, created God. So all 72 change the pasuk to read, Elokim Bara Bereshis, God created in the beginning. Next. Ase Adam b'tzelem u'bidimus. How does the Torah record it? Naase Adam, let us make man b'tzalmeinu k'dmuseinu, in our form and in our image. Now Rashi comments, quoting the Gemara, why does the Torah say it plural? So remember, again, Rashi points out that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is including the Malachim. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu based, you know, God was very smart. God, of course, HaKadosh Baruch Hu understood that there was always going to be tension between the celestial sphere and the earth. that everybody's angling for the attention of God. Mankind wants it, the angels want it. So what is the best way? This is a good life lesson in general. The best way to diffuse potential tension is include people in the process. If you make people part of the process, you have the ability to diffuse the tension. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu realized, if I just create man unilaterally, the angels are going to be upset. So what does God say to the angels? Na'asa Adam. Let's do it together. HaKadosh Baruch Hu includes them in the process, diffuses that celestial earthly animosity. Of course, again, here's the problem. If Ptolemy gets his hand on that pasuk, what's going to happen? He's going to say, oh, polytheism. Remember, again, the Greeks are very into their mythology. The Greeks are very into their polytheistic. They had a god for everything. So wonderful. We're going to see now, Na'ase, plural. Let us make man in our image, plural, in our form, plural. It's a perfect proof for polytheism. Therefore, they all changed it to E'ese Adam. I will make man in the form, in the image. Next, Vayichal Bayom HaShishi, Vayishbos Bayom HaShvi'i. Remember, what does the pasuk say? Vayichal Elokim Bayom HaShvi'i. The pasuk says God stopped on the seventh day. Now, from creation, when it sounds like God stopped, on the seventh day, what does that sound like? That God worked into the seventh day and then stopped, which means God did melacha on Shabbos. Now, the Gemara explains that what does it mean, Vayichal Elokim Bayom HaShvi'i? The amazing part about God is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is able to know the exact moment that the sixth day ends and the seventh day begins, something that man cannot do. Of course, Talmud is not going to understand that, so therefore they have to change it to God completed his work on the sixth day and he rested on the seventh. And again, the Gemara goes on and gives a number. Let's skip down a little bit. He says, Vatitzchak Sara Bikroveha. Actually, yeah. Okay, so we don't have to go through all these. It's quite interesting. You could look up this Gemara also, Megillah Daf Tasamud Aleph. So he gives a number of these different changes. So why is this important for us? The Medrash brings down that Talmi assembled the 72 elders on the 8th of Teves. And the Medrash writes that this was such almost like a cataclysmic event that a darkness descended on the world for 3 days on the 8th of Teves, the 9th of Teves, and the most intense of the darkness was felt on the 10th of Teves. So the 10th of Teves, writes the Medrash, is when we go ahead and we mourn what we call, what do we call this, by the way? This is also known as the Septuagint. Right, this is a Septuagint, the famous Septuagint, the Greek. Again, remember, this is not just like a mice of the Gemara, right? Meaning history records this event as well, of the translation of the Torah into Greek, the Septuagint. So ultimately, again, now you'll say to yourself, well, what's so mournful about this? What's so terrible about Greek, about translating the Torah into Greek? Because what this represented was almost like a societal adulteration of our Mesorah. This idea was that once the Torah was put into the hands of the Greeks, even with all of these changes, it opened it up for biblical criticism. It opened it up for all the different things. Until this point in time, the truth is the Torah was our possession. The Torah was ours. It was ours. It belonged to Klal Yisrael. It was kept within the ranks of Klal Yisrael. Once now it was translated into Greek, it opened it up for the entire world. Now one would say there are certain benefits to that, and there are. History has shown us that mankind's exposure to Torah has produced certain positive things, but on the other hand, what it also did is it opened up our beautiful Mesorah to a certain amount of global or mankind criticism, sarcasm, which over time has eroded some of the beauty, sanctity, and holiness of our Mesorah. So really, if we globalize this a little bit, according to this approach, what we fast for on Tisha B'Av is time to take, excuse me, not on Tisha B'Av, on Asara B'Teves, thank you, is taking stock of the impact that the greater world has on our Torah. The truth is, this is a very important idea. You know, I always say it's very easy to live in black and white, right? It's easy to say that the world is treif, and you must make your life as insular as possible, blocking out anything and everything as much as you can. That's easy, because if everything is treif, then by definition, you don't have to worry about in any way compromising yourself. It's a much greater challenge in life, and I think it's not just a challenge, I think it's the obligation of the Jew to live in both worlds. You have to live in both worlds. Why? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not create us just to be an insular community for ourselves. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created us to go ahead and be an Or LaGoyim, to be a light unto the nations. But one can't be a light unto the nations if one is cocooned. One has to be able to keep 1.5 feet in the world of Torah, but also be able to somehow have an influence on greater society as well. But we have to understand that living in those two worlds, and the truth is we all do to differing degrees, comes sometimes with an incredible danger. That sometimes, and this is very important to always be mindful of those dangers, that sometimes when we are part of greater society, when we live in greater society, that being embedded in greater society sometimes dulls our spiritual senses, sometimes erodes the sanctity, the holiness, and the intensity of our Mesorah. So the answer is not therefore run away from having anything to do with society. Some might advocate for that. I don't believe that's the answer, just my one person's opinion. But rather, we just have to create a sensitivity to it. So Asara Beteves is the day when we take a step back and we take stock. Am I practicing my Judaism in the way that I really should be? Or perhaps have other societal influences perhaps numbed me spiritually a little bit? Am I really the Jew I should be? Or somehow is my Yiddishkeit influenced by other alien influences that have dulled it a bit? And this is a very difficult question, because the truth is, as insular as one may be, we still all live in society to some degree, and it is impossible to fully escape the grasp of society in totality. So if I can't fully escape it, at least I have to be mindful of the potential deleterious effects. And this is true. I can't, again, this is not our topic for today, but the effects that we have on society in such subconscious ways. A person has a television, a person has internet, and I'm not telling you what you should or what you shouldn't have in your homes. That you'll make your own decisions. But a person should realize that there are things that permeate our homes in ways that we're not even aware of. A person has a newspaper. I'm all for reading the newspaper. But a person should ultimately be aware that even newspapers today, one can't be assured of just the kashrus and the tara of anything. And we sometimes become so dulled to it. But it's a reality that impacts our Jewish lives each and every day. So again, the answer is not to run away. The answer is not to cocoon yourself. The answer is not to become insular. But the answer is yes, continue to have an impact on society. Continue to be part of greater society. But be ever vigilant about the impact that that societal exposure has on your Judaism. And make sure that in some way you are guarding yourself against a spiritual erosion on the backdrop of societal influence. That's Asara B'Teves. Because on Asara B'Teves we fast for the first societal erosion of our Judaism. The Septuagint, the giving the Torah over to the Greeks, opened our Torah up to societal impact. For that we fast, and again, for that we introspect, to ask ourselves, how is society shaping my Yiddishkeit? And how do I go ahead and take back my Judaism from certain societal impacts? How do I make sure that my relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is pure, pristine, and holy, despite the fact that I am also part of greater society? A second approach to this fast day. And this is quite amazing. I have to thank all of you for giving me the opportunity to teach this year, because I never saw this until yesterday. Take a look at number 3. So from Megillas Esther. Ubahagia tar Esther bas Avichael dod Mordechai, asher lakach lo levas, lovo al ha-melech, lo biksha davar ki im es asher yomar hegai siris ha-melech, shomar anashim, vahati Esther nosas chen be'enei koroes. So remember again, give you a little bit of context, Esther is taken to the king's harem against her will. She's given 12 months like all of the girls are to prepare for their night with the king. She does not want anything. Her turn finally comes. Pasuk Tezayin 16. Vatilakach Esther el hamelech achashirosh el beis malchuso. Bachodesh ha'asiri hu chodesh teves. Bishnas sheva l'malchuso. And Esther is taken to the king in the 10th month, which is the month of Teves, in the 7th year of his reign. Vayehav ha'melech es Esther mikal anoshim. The king loved Esther from all of the women that he was with. Vatisachin v'chesed lefanav. She carried favor with him. Mikal b'sulos. Vayosem kesra malchus b'rosho. V'yamlicha tachas vashti. Placed the crown on her head, and he inaugurated her as queen. You understand something amazing? The Medrash says, when was Esther Hamalka taken to Achashverosh? Anasara B'Teves. Estra Malkus taken to Achashverosh Anasara Batevis. So you say to yourself, okay, so what's going on over here? You know, I think we've spoken about this in the past with Estra Malka. It's very important to understand. Soloveitchik points this out in a very dramatic fashion, which is that, you know, when we finish the Megillah, when we finish reading the Megillah, so we burst into song Shoshanas Yaakov, and it's wonderful, we're celebrating. And the truth is, Purim was incredible for everyone except Esther. Right? That for Esther and Mordechai, true. It's a lady's shear, so I was trying to pay up the Esther piece a little bit more. But Mordechai, yes, thank you. So again, it's everybody's salvation, it's wonderful, everybody's happy, everybody's celebrating. But here, Esther Hamelka is confined to a life with a man whom she did not want to be with. And that's probably putting it mildly, right? A man with whom she shared nothing more than perhaps a physical relationship. And that's her life. That's her life for the rest of her life. So perhaps what the Medrash is highlighting over here is the following idea. You know, if you look at all of our other fast days, Shiva Ser B'Tammuz, certainly Tisha B'Av, even Tzom Gedalia, the third of Tishrei, the focus is always on national tragedy. It's always on national tragedy. It's always about things that happen to us as a people. You know, there's a danger when you only focus on national tragedy, which is that you forget the plight of the individual. Perhaps what the Medrash is trying to convey to us is that the reason we fast on Asara B'Teves is to also become focused on the plight and the realities of individual suffering. Asara B'Teves was the day Esther Amalka was taken to Achashverosh. Now, the fact that Esther Amalka was taken to Achashverosh, did that impact, leaving aside Mordechai, did that impact anyone else? Do you think anyone stopped for a moment and said, wow, today's the day that Esther is being taken to Achashverosh? No. What did everyone else, what was everyone else in Shushan and the outlying kingdoms doing on the 10th of Teves? Whatever they were doing on the 9th of Teves or on the 11th of Teves, nothing changed. Because what often happens is that sometimes people become indifferent to the plight and to the suffering of the individual. When something happens to the nation, everyone is awakened. But when something happens to the individual, very often, individual suffering or individual difficulty simply goes unnoticed. Not because we don't care. Not because we're not empathic or sympathetic individuals. Chas v'shalom. It's simply because we're busy with life. And perhaps what the fast of Asara B'Teves serves to sensitize us to is to the plight of the individual, to make sure to be vigilant and to be aware of the individuals perhaps within our sphere, within our circle, who may be having difficult times, perhaps not as dramatic as Esther Amalka, but to be a little bit more sensitive to those within our midst who perhaps are suffering. Yes, it's not a national crisis, and Klal Yisrael Baruch Hashem is okay, but we all know that even when Klal Yisrael, as a nation, is okay in Baruch Hashem, we are privileged to live in a time where Klal Yisrael is more than okay. Klal Yisrael, we are thriving, we are strong, we are beautiful, we are holy, we're fantastic. But even in times where there's not, thank God, a national crisis, there's always individual crises. There are always people in need. There are always people suffering. There are always people having a difficult time. And it's incumbent upon us to be sensitive to the plight of the individual. You know, whenever there's a crisis in Klal Yisrael, there are always the Tehillim rallies, and there are always what can we do, and that's beautiful. I'm not saying we have to call a Tehillim rally every single time there's an individual in crisis, but the same way that there's like a motivation to act when Klal Yisrael is in difficult straits, that same urgency has to be there whenever I know that an individual is in need as well. Perhaps not as public, perhaps without the communal asifa, but at the end of the day, to always react. Fortunately, Esther Hamalka's plight, to a certain degree, probably went ignored by the general populace. Not because they didn't care, but also because many of them were in the same exact boat. We fast on Asara B'Teves to sensitize ourselves to the plight, to the needs, and to the difficulties of the individual, but not just to sensitize ourselves to know that these crises exist, but to sensitize ourselves to realize that we need to take action, we need to do something, we each need some way, somehow, to try to ameliorate and lessen the difficulty and suffering of the other. If you look at number four, a third approach. So this actually was from a very nice article that appeared just 2 days ago in Arut Sheva. So in Arut Sheva, they had a statement from the chief rabbi, from Rabbi Lau, Rabbi David Lau, he writes the following. He writes, Harav Lau, Lomar Mishnayus Vekadish Ba'asara B'teves. So Rabbi Lau came out with a declaration that one should go ahead and learn Mishnayus and recite Mourner's Kaddish on the 10th of Teves. Harav Rashi, Pirsim Kriya Litzibur, Lomar Mishnayus Vekadish Ba'asara B'teves, Lezecher Kidoshe HaShoah, Hashem Yikom Damo. That Asara B'teves is a national day of mourning for those who were lost in the Holocaust. Look at the left-hand paragraph. Likras tzom asara b'teves, sheyachol b'yom chamishya karov, mefarasim harav harashi liyiso harav David Lau, kriya letzibor lomar kandish lezecher kidoshi ha'shoa Hashem yikom damo. So coming up to Tisha B'Av, Rav David Lau, chief rabbi, Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Israel, made a declaration. I'm sorry. Thank you, Anna. Sorry, Bateves, thank you. That making a declaration that we should learn Mishnayos and recite Kaddish for those murdered in the Holocaust. B'kriyasa kosev Rav Lau, in his declaration, Rabbi Lau wrote, B'yom chavzayin b'kislev tavshin yud alif, kava mo'etzes harabanut harashit liYisrael, u'barasham harabonim, harav Herzog and Rav Ben Sion Chai Uziel, litzayin b'chol shana es tzom asara b'teves kiyom hakadish haklali. So this is not as well known in America. It's much more well known in Eretz Yisrael that the chief rabbinate, this was a good 40, 50 years ago. Yeah, 60 years ago, established by Rav Herzog and Rav Ben and Rav Uziel, Sephardic chief rabbi, Ashkenazic chief rabbi, that Asara B'Teves is the national day of mourning for Holocaust victims. That it's the national day of mourning for, and we'll see, we'll qualify that in just a moment. Harabanut Harashit Kavas Yom Zeh Likdoshe Hashoah Asher Nergu Nitpechu V'Nishchetu B'Tkufa Ayumazu V'Tarich Pitirasam U'Makom Kvurasam Ina Yadua. That for those whose date of death is unknown, for those who perished in the Holocaust, but the family does not know when, the yard site that is observed is Asara B'Teves. Asara B'Teves is National Day of Mourning. You have to understand something, that remember, Yom HaShoah came as a later innovation. Remember, Yom HaShoah is an interesting day because Yom HaShoah has never been fully accepted within all ranks of the Orthodox community as a Holocaust Remembrance Day for the simple reason that it was established during Nisan. And again, it was established to correspond to the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, but it's in Nisan. And the problem in Nisan of establishing a day of mourning is that one is not supposed to engage in public conspicuous mourning on the month of Nisan. So it's interesting. So the chief rabbinate decided to establish it on Asara B'Teves, that is the date at which we mourn. So even that's not accepted by everyone. Still many feel that the proper day for Holocaust remembrance is on Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is the day that we mourn all Jewish catastrophe. Whether it happened 70 years ago, 2,000 years ago, Tisha B'Av is the central date. There was a feeling by the chief rabbinate that there needs to be a specific day for the Holocaust. That for something so fresh and for something so enormous, remember again, there were more lives lost in the Holocaust than any other Jewish tragedy throughout. We know that even when the Romans sacked Yerushalayim, there was a terrible loss of life. There were 1 million Jews slaughtered by the Romans when they overtook Yerushalayim. But again, there were 6 million wiped out by the Nazis, Yimach Shemam V'Zichram. So the chief rabbinate established that Asara B'Teves is the date to observe for those who do not know the date of death of their loved ones. See, so Rabbi Lau writes, Al pi halacha, maskar Rav Rashi, im lo yadua yom ha-ptira, karov ha-mishpacha tzarech likvo lo yom miyuchad b'shana bo yom ha-kadosh v'yis'ana. Now the halacha is that if you don't know the date in which a loved one passed away, then there is an obligation to set a date. So essentially what the chief rabbinate did is they set the date as Asara B'Teves. Harav Rashi Mosif Apono Letzibor Bishanim Ha'achronos Pederach Kala Aretz. Listen to what he writes over here. So the chief rabbi said, in latter years, in the way of the land, Nisma'it Hador Sha'adayin Omer Kadesh Al Krovav Shenergo B'Shoah. One of the unfortunate realities that we are now contending with is the generation of survivors is now dying out. And there are and again, unfortunately, collective memory begins to wane, begins to ebb away. Avakesh me'atzibor shemishu karv l'kdoshe ha'shoah. So Rabbi Lau wrote, I request from the tzibor that anyone ultimately who has a relative who died in the Holocaust, v'yachol, sheyomar kadish li'ilu nishmasam, v'im ein karov, Ro'i shemishu achar yomer es hakadosh. So again, Rabbi Lau wrote that again, it is important, of incredible importance, that we make sure to eternalize the memory of the kedoshim who perished in the war, in the Holocaust, and therefore again, if you have relatives, say kaddish. If not, just say kaddish in general. He says, kimo ken yishlom v'atei kinesios la'achar kriyas tor b'tfilas shachris b'tfilas oshu b'tfilas kelmol irachanim l'zochram lilmod mishtayis ili nishmasam u'lahalik avuram ner zikaron. So of course, again, this idea, Rabbi Lau, this is not instead of the previous ideas. And I want to point out, none of these ideas are mutually exclusive. Everything works together. But this idea that Rabbi Lau is, the reason I brought this on is because this is a more contemporary understanding as to what it is that we are commemorating as well. Not just historical events of the Septuagint, not just the individual tragedy of Esther Hamalka, but again, it is the day for those that do not have a yahrzeit, for family that perished in the Holocaust to be able to observe a yahrzeit, recite Kaddish, Kalmali Rachmim, and Limun Mishnayis. Which now brings us to our last approach, which we have a couple of minutes left. So we'll try to go through it. So now again, remember, so our first three approaches, and again, I can't say enough, none of these are mutually exclusive. And again, there are others that I'm not sharing with you today. You'll Google it, and Amir Tashem, you'll find the other approaches as well. So again, remember, so far we have, on a national level, the Septuagint. And remember, again, as the reason we started off with our Mishnah Berurah, that the point of learning these reasons is not because, oh, wow, that's interesting, that's why we fast. But each of these reasons give us a different understanding as to what the introspective idea of the day truly is. So according to the first approach, that we fast on Tisha B'Av, again, because of the Septuagint, Tisha B'Av is the, excuse me, I keep saying Tisha B'Av, thank you, Asara B'Teves, that we fast on Asara B'Teves because of the Septuagint, that the avod of Asara B'Teves is to introspect and to think about, am I practicing a real, beautiful, holy, and authentic Judaism, or has my Judaism somehow been tarnished by certain societal influences? And if it has been tarnished by societal influences, how do I reclaim my Judaism? How do I get back my personal Masorah? That's number one. Approach number two, which was, again, Esther Amalka. Other fast days are focused on national tragedy. Asara B'Teves is focused on individual tragedy. What can I do to become more sensitive to the plight of those around me who are having difficulties in life? Third approach, the Holocaust. Again, very important, especially in our dar, in our generation, to keep a sensitivity to the incredible Khurban that just wiped out a large percentage of our people just 70 years ago. It's not 2,000 years ago, it's not 1,000 years ago, it's not a structural base, HaMikdash, it's not a crusade. Mamish happened, and there are still people to tell about it. We have to make sure that we sensitize, because we also have to realize, you know, we say at every single Bris Milah, we tell a little baby boy, the first message we give him, a boy in his chinuch is, v'amar lach b'damayich chayi, v'amar lach b'damayich. You are here today because of generations that came before you that died al kiddush Hashem. We are here today because of those that were willing to give their lives for our God, for our religion, for our Torah. And that is an important lesson, and one that we cannot forget. We owe an incredible debt of gratitude towards previous generations, but gratitude is not enough. If they've given our lives so that we could have our Yiddishkeit, that we could have our Judaism, how seriously we must take that sacred obligation. We finally come now to our fourth approach. And our fourth approach, I save the most well-known approach, our understanding of Asara B'Teves, for last. What's the most well-known understanding? Take a look at number five. So in Sefer Melachim, we learn, Vahi bishnas hatshiyas l'malcho, b'chodesh ha'asiri b'asor l'chodesh, and it was in the ninth year of his reign. In the 10th month, on the 10th of the month, Ba Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel, Hu V'chol Chelo Al Yerushalayim. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the Babylonian Empire, marches on Yerushalayim with his entire army. Vayichan Aleha, he camped around it. Vayivnu Aleha Dayek Saviv. He camped about it and built forts around it. And the city came under siege until the 11th year of King Tzidkiyahu. So again, what happened according to the Navi on the 10th of Teves? What happened on Asara B'Teves? Nebuchadnezzar lays siege to Yerushalayim. Of course, again, Nebuchadnezzar is first temple, Bayis Rishon. Again, the siege in Yerushalayim, which lasted a number of years, begins on the 10th of Teves. And in fact, again, if you take a look at number 7, just skipping a little bit because of time, the Gemara says, Som ha'asiri, what is the month of the 10th fast, or the fast of the 10th month? Says the Gemara number 7, Ze'asara b'Teves. This is the fast of Teves. And what happened on the fast of the 10th of Teves? Shebo Samach Melech Bavel al Yerushalayim. It was on the 10th of Teves that Nebuchadnezzar lays siege to Yerushalayim. Shenemar Vahidvar Hashem Elai. Okay, he goes on. So go now to number 8. And in fact, the Mishnah Berurah writes in number 8, he says, Va'asara b'Teves Shebo Samach Melech Bavel. So ultimately, again, Asara B'Teves is the day in which Nebuchadnezzar lays siege to Yerushalayim, and of course, this siege was the beginning of the destruction. Now, there's something very interesting to note over here. If you look at number 9, so the Gemara Maseches Tanis writes, "Hufka ir b'tishasar." So this is one of the last Mishnah in Maseches Tanis. So discusses various events that occurred on different days. So for example, the Mishnah says that the walls of Yerushalayim were breached on the 17th of Tammuz. So the Gemara says, is that really true? V'haksiv b'chodesh harevi b'tisha l'chodesh v'aychazek harav b'ir k'siv b'asrei v'atibaka ha'ir. But yet the Navi says that the walls weren't breached on the 17th of Tammuz, they were breached on the 9th of Tammuz. To which the Gemara says, Amar avalo kashya kan barishona kan b'shniya. Disanya barishona hufka ir b'tisha b'tammuz o b'shniya b'shivasar b'tammuz. So we know in the first temple, the walls are breached on the 9th of Tammuz. Second temple, the walls are breached on the 17th of Tammuz. We don't fast for the first temple anymore. We fast for the second temple. So we know we're fasting on the 17th of Tammuz because the walls were breached. We know we're fasting, as the Gemara says in number 10, we're fasting on the 9th of Av. Why? Why? Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. So we find ourselves with a very simple question. Why do we fast on the day that Nebuchadnezzar laid siege to Yerushalayim? And this question is a two-part question. Number one, if we're already fasting on the day that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, so shouldn't that fast encompass the entire process, the entire continuum of destruction? Why is it that we have to fast on the day that the siege was? Why do I have to go back to the beginning? And the question is compounded. Because remember, again, do we fast on the 9th of Tammuz? Right? Why not? As I just said before, that's the first temple. And we pretty much only fast in accordance with the events that happened of the second temple. If that's the case, then what? When Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the base, which temple was Nebuchadnezzar involved with? Number one. So again, the question is compounded. Why are we fasting on the 10th of Teves at all? 10th of Teves has to do with the first Beis HaMikdash, the same way that we don't fast on the 9th of Tammuz, which is the day that the walls of the first temple were breached. Instead, we just fast on the 17th of Tammuz. We shouldn't be fasting on the 10th of Teves at all. That's first temple era. So it's a two-part question. Number one, why are we fasting for a first temple event at all? Which is a secondary question. But the real primary question is, if I'm already fasting for the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, why is there the need for an additional fast on the day in which the siege began? And remember, that was a 3-year siege. So why do I have to fast on the day that the siege began? So to answer this question, I actually want to draw your attention to something that happened in last week's parasha. The Torah says something very, very moving. Number 11. Vayipol al tzavarei binyamin achiv, vayef, ubinyamin bacha al tzavarav. So the Torah says, this is talking about after Yosef revealed his identity to his brothers. So the Torah relates that he fell, Yosef fell, al tzavarei binyamin achiv. Now tzavarei literally means what? Necks, plural. Necks, plural. He fell on the necks of his brother, and he cried, "Ubinyamin bacha al tzavarav." And Binyamin also cried on Yosef's neck, singular. So Yosef is falling on Binyamin's neck, plural. Binyamin is falling on Yosef's neck, singular. So what's happening over here? So if you look at the Radak says, don't read too much into it. Rather, vayipo ki hayu achim me'av ve'ein. Leficha hayu ohavim ze ze yoser ubachol kol echad ze al ze. So the Radak understands that when it says that he fell on Binyamin's necks, so that's just trying to say that Yosef cried with all of his brothers, but he cried with Binyamin even more than anyone else. Why? Because Binyamin was the only brother with whom he shared both a father and a mother. So the outpouring of emotion between those two brothers was even more intense than everyone else. The Netziv on the other end says, in number 13, he says, Shneitz dade hatsavar. So the Netziv says a little bit differently. But what about the fact that it says that Yosef fell on Binyamin's necks, plural? It meant that Yosef cried so much that he first cried on one side of Binyamin's neck, like his hand was by his neck, and then he went to the other side. It was so much tears, so much crying, such an outpouring of emotion that Yosef literally had to switch sides. After crying on one side, he went to the other side. But Rashi, of course, quotes the Gemara. And the Gemara says something very profound. The Gemara says, Vayipa al tzavari binyamin achi vayif. What does it mean? He fell on his brother's neck, on the neck of binyamin, and he cried. Ashnei mikdashos sha'asidin liyos bechalko shabinyamin v'sofan lecharev. Next, says the Gemara, is reference to the Beis HaMikdash. By the way, we see this, I should have included on the sheet, in Shir HaShirim. Remember Shir HaShirim, which is this entire beautiful allegorical song. Shlomo HaMelech also refers to the Beis HaMikdash as the neck. Because again, remember, the neck is important because without the neck, the head cannot be supported. So the neck is that which supports everything. So the Beis HaMikdash, so therefore, Rashi in the second quote in the Gemara, that when it says that Yosef cried on the necks of Binyamin, it means that Yosef saw Binevuah about the destruction of both Batei Mikdash. Now remember, the Beis HaMikdash straddled the tribal area of Binyamin and Yehuda, but a good part of it was in the area of Shevet Binyamin. So Yosef saw the two Batei Mikdash that would be destroyed, and he cried for them. O Binyamin Bachat Savarav. What does it mean that Binyamin cried on Yosef's neck? Number 14, second line. Al Mishkan Shilo Sha'asid Liyos Bechelko Sha Yosef Vesof Alecharev. What is Binyamin crying about? Binyamin was crying about the destruction of the Mishkan in Shiloh. Shiloh was the tribal area of Yosef, or better stated, the tribal area of Manasseh and Ephraim, that was going to be destroyed. So Rashi, something amazing is happening over here. Everyone thinks they're crying tears of joy over the reunification. No, Yosef is crying over the necks, plural. The two Batei Mikdash that would be in the tribal area of Binyamin that would be destroyed, and Binyamin is crying over the neck, the Mishkan, that would be over in the tribal area of Yosef that would be destroyed. Look at number 15. Asks Rabbi Yecheskel Mikazmir. Rabbi Yecheskel of Kazmir was one of the great Hasidic luminaries. See, he writes the following, quotes Rashi, and skip down three lines in number 15, right after you see where it says Rashi in the parentheses. Lichora kasha. So Rabbi Yecheskel of Kazmir says, I don't understand. This is difficult. Shebishas chedva kazu, yifku ala chorbano sa'asidin. What's going on over here? Right? Even if they saw it prophetically, why are they crying about that now? Why are they crying about that now? Meaning, this is a time of reunification. The family is finally together. The brothers are reunited. Remember, again, the last vestige they each have of their mother is where? Is where? Is in one another. Right? Remember, again, that's the last vestige they have of their beloved mothers, one another. Rejoice in this time together. Why are they mourning for the Beis HaMikdash? Remember, again, the Beis HaMikdash is a bit way off, right? It's not like in the immediate future. There's a lot of other stuff that's going to be happening. Why are they dafka crying about this now? And if Chesel Kazmir gives a beautiful idea, he says, Umadua bacha kol echad al churban shebechelko shel hasheni, velo al churban shebechelko shelo. Furthermore, he says, and why is each one crying over the churban of the other? Right? Meaning, Yosef is crying over the two Batei Mikdash that will be in Binyamin's tribal area. Binyamin is crying over the Mishkan that's going to be in Yosef's tribal area. So I have a good idea. Why don't we all cry for our own stuff? Right? Let Yosef cry for the Mishkan. Let Binyamin cry for the two Batei Mikdash. Why is everyone crying for the other? And Rav Chisrov of Kazmir gives, it's just a beautiful answer. He says, Ella, Shadvaram Uzbaram Kach. Rav Chisrov Kazmir says, I'm going to explain it to you. He says, Ki Yadua, Nechrav Batei HaMikdash Ba'avon Sinas Chinam. We knew that the Beis HaMikdash, now remember again, everyone associates Sinas Chinam with the second temple. And why was the first temple destroyed? Three cardinal sins of immorality, idolatry, and murder. Now, you'll understand that in order to have a society that is rampantly engaged in immorality, idolatry, and society, what else are you lacking? Right? A certain amount of togetherness, right? Immorality means that I don't respect the relationships of another and will infringe on those. Murder means I don't respect the life of the other and therefore, again, I'll take it. Idolatry means, remember, idolatry doesn't just mean simply that I'm worshiping another god. It means that there's a breakdown of the entire Judaic system, a major pillar of which is the pillar of chesed. Where there is idolatry, there is no chesed. So Rabbi Chesed of Kazmir says, there was fundamental sinas chinam, animosity, that was present in both the first and second temple eras, and that was the very reason for the destruction. Just in the first Beis HaMikdash, in the first temple era, that sinas chinam took on a more targeted form of avodah zarah, idolatry, immorality, and murder. And the second temple was just general animosity, but it was animosity that destroyed both temples. Look what he writes. He says, Ukasha nifkishu Yosef and Binyamin. When Yosef and Binyamin met, the Yadu, meaning when they were reunited, the Yadu Sha Perud Beinehem, Ba Biglal Sinas Chinam. They realized that again, why did this whole separation occur? Why was Yosef sold by his brothers? It was Sinas Chinam. It was baseless hatred. You know, baseless hatred doesn't mean you don't have a reason to hate someone. Everybody has a reason, but the problem just is the reason very often is not a good one. So the brothers had a reason to hate Yosef. They didn't like him. They thought it was immature. His dreams were ridiculous. They thought it was being divisive. But at the end of the day, it was sinas chinam. So Yosef and Binyamin meet after 22 years of painful separation. And they realize that the reason they were separated was because of animosity between Jews. And you know what they realized in that very moment? They realized that moment that this is not the last time that sinas chinam will divide our people. This is not the last time that animosity will tear our people apart. Sha'af heim yehiyu ba'avon sinas chinam al kach bahu. You know what they cried about? They cried about the fact, you know, it's one thing if you endure a tragic event or tumultuous or turbulent times, but you know that those times are behind you. Okay, at least there's some solace in knowing the difficulties are behind us, we can move on. But the pain is so intense when you know that you're not at the finish line yet, when you know that the very reason for your pain is going to surface again. Yosef and Binyamin somehow understood that the sinas chinam that tore their family apart for 22 years, it's not over. It's not over. It's going to resurface again and cause incredible pain and heartache. He says, "V'hoil v'hatikun l'sinas chinam." So again, so says Rav Chesed of Kazmir, that's what it means. Like, so Rav Chesed of Kazmir says, does it literally mean that Yosef cried over the destruction of the two temples that would be in the tribal area of Binyamin? And does it literally mean that Binyamin cried over the Mishkan? So it could be literal, but it doesn't have to be literal. What it could also mean is what? That they somehow just understood that sinas chinam was going to rear its ugly head again. That our people would be divisive in the future. That we would become our worst, own worst enemies. That we would hurt each other. That we would trample on one another. They saw this. They felt it. And they were so broken by it that what? That they began to cry over it together. But listen to this. He says, V'hoil v'atikim l'sinas chinam, hu chizuk ha'ava ha'adadis. But again, remember, what's the answer to sinas chinam? So we call it ahavas chinam. So there's only one simple answer to sinas chinam, to animosity and hatred, which is to love every Jew, to find a way to love every Jew. And by the way, you know, we all know this, but the details come in is how you define every Jew. People often add in, of course, I have to love every Jew, like me, right? Or I have to love every Jew who I identify with. That's not ahavas chinam. Ahavas chinam means the ability to love every single Jew. And I often say, you know, again, that's true, by the way, about the guys who are protesting, you know, every year, the March for Israel parade. So you have the Neturei Karta who are out there. You know what? You can vehemently disagree with them. You still have to love them as Jews. And it refers to the person who, again, might be the Reconstructionist Jews, totally unaffiliated with it. Okay, I have to love everybody. It doesn't matter if they're firmer than me, less firm than me, believe like me, practice like me. That's what Ahavas Yisrael means. Not just to love the Jews like you, that's easy, that's obvious, but to love every single person. So what did they do? How did they instill Ahavas Chinam? He said, Shetzar hazulas, v'hoel v'atikam l'sinas chinam, hu achizok ha'ava adadis, Shetzar hazulas yechayiv l'cha yosir mitzarecha shalcha. What's the greatest litmus test? If you really have Ahavas Yisrael, this is amazing, so Rechezelos Kazmir, the greatest litmus test if you have Ahavas Yisrael is, does someone else's pain hurt you as much as your own? If I know that someone else is suffering, if that hurts me as much as my own, then I have Ahavas Yisrael. Therefore, how did Yosef and Binyamin show that the other's pain hurts them as much as their own? Bacha kol echad ala churban shebechelko shel chaveiro. Yosef cries over Binyamin's pain Binyamin cries over Yosef's pain in a brotherly effort to stave off the effects and impact of sinas chinam. Sinas chinam means we don't care about each other. Sinas chinam means we totally disregard one another. Avas chinam means I love you like I love myself. I care about you like I care about myself. I feel your pain like I feel my own pain. How do they express that? Yosef could have cried for his own loss. Binyamin should have cried for his own loss. But again, the demonstration of avas chinam was they each cried for the other's loss. Va'af al pi shebeis hamikdash. And he takes it a step further. Even though you could not have had a temple without the destruction of the Mishkan, Binyamin said, and again, I don't know where he gets this from, but it's an incredible idea. He says that Binyamin said to himself, you know what? Better for us to be without a Beis HaMikdash if it's going to spare my brother a little bit of pain. Of course, that's not our decision. That's Kadosh Baruch Hu's decision. But what's unfolding over here, says V'cheskel Kazmir, is an incredible, incredible idea. Namely, but what I want to focus, we could speak a lot about Avas Chinam and Sinas Chinam, but instead what I want to focus to you over here is that Yosef and Binyamin realized that what? That what had unfolded with their family was the beginning. Remember again what happened with Yosef and his brothers was the first event of national sinas chinam. And that first event, you know, sometimes before something happens, so you can't imagine that it's ever going to happen, then once that thing happens, suddenly it becomes a reality. You know, we see this all the time in Klal Yisrael when we go ahead and we encounter tragedies. So again, over the summer, when the three precious Kedoshim were kidnapped, it was the worst tragedy Klal Yisrael could ever imagine. Okay, then what happens? You think nothing worse could ever happen. Then there's a massacre in a shul in Har Nof. So the way the human mind works is that before something happens, it's not a reality. Once it happens, it becomes a reality. What Yosef and Binyamin are crying about is that sinas chinam has now become a reality. Sinas chinam is now present. It's now here. And once it becomes a reality, what's the danger? What's the danger? That it's going to be repeated again in the future. Now, why is this important? Let's bring this all the way back. What is Asara B'Tevi? So what Yosef and Binyamin were saying was, that act of Sinas Chinam, what they were crying about, is that act of Sinas Chinam, what did it really do? What in essence did it do? It paved the way for the Sinas Chinam that a number of generations later would destroy the first and second Bate Mikdash. That act of Sinas Chinam, so remember again, the Sinas Chinam that came about during the first and second temple eras, that didn't come out of nowhere. That wasn't Yeshman. There wasn't something wrong. Just somebody woke up one day and said, hey, you know what? Let's try out the Sinas Chinam. That they had historical precedent for it. It came from the brothers. That act of Sinas Chinam that tore a family apart laid the groundwork ultimately for the Sinas Chinam that destroyed our first Beis HaMikdash and the Sinas Chinam that destroyed our second Beis HaMikdash. Come back to Asara B'Teves. What is it that we focus on Asara B'Teves? What are we focusing on? We're focusing on the siege of Nebuchadnezzar. Why focus on the siege? Perhaps what Chazal are trying to teach us is the idea that things in life do not happen in an instant. The realities in which we are faced with in life are a result of much smaller events along the journey, along the way. And those smaller events often combine together to ultimately produce much bigger events, both good and bad. So what happened? We could mark the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. What's the problem with that? If you just focus on the destruction, then what do you run the risk of? Only focusing on the destruction and not focusing on what? Why? What were the events that led up to a destruction of the temple? So what Chazal did is, Chazal forced us to mourn the destruction of the temple at every single stage. We mourn the siege, we mourn the breach, and then we mourn the destruction. To tell us that the destruction of a Beis HaMikdash did not just occur poof one day, it was a result of sustained negative behaviors that went on and on and on unchecked. Negative behaviors that began with Yosef and his brothers, unfortunately continued throughout our history and culminated in the destruction of the first and second Bate Mikdash. That's the essence of Asara B'Teves, to recognize that things don't happen in life just 1, 2, 3. The things that happen in our lives, both good and bad, are a result of very often sustained behaviors in which we engage in. And if we take this approach, then Asar B'Teves is a very powerful day. Because sometimes things happen in our life that we're not happy with, and we get very upset, and we feel like our whole journey has been derailed, and we wonder, how did this happen? Or very often we don't ask how, we ask why. Sometimes you have to realize that when something doesn't go right for us in life, and again, I'm talking about where often there's a level of human error involved, we have to ask ourselves, well, how have I been living? What decisions have I made until now? How do I live my day-to-day life? What are the smaller decisions that I'm making? Because very often things happen in life, and they're big events, and it's then that we do a cheshbon nefesh and realize, my gosh, how did I get here? That's Asara B'Teves. Asara B'Teves is the day in which we realize that the small decisions we make on a day-to-day level ultimately come together and coalesce to form the larger results in life. And so if we want good results from life, if I want to lead a productive and meaningful life, it's not just enough to go ahead and make the good big decisions, because there are big decisions, but rather a good life is directly related to what? My ability to make the correct smaller decisions. The siege, the breakthrough of the wall. It's those smaller decisions in life. And again, this is for good and for bad. When something goes terribly wrong or my life did not turn out the way that I wanted it to, again, I'm not talking about things like sickness or things like that that are outside of our hands. I'm talking about sometimes our life just takes a wrong turn and I'm really unhappy with how my life turned out. I need to do a cheshbon nefesh. How have I been living? What decisions have I been making? How has my day-to-day been? Because if I haven't maximized my day-to-day, or I've made a number of smaller bad decisions, then it's not a surprise that I end up where I am. But on the flip side as well, if I want beautiful results out of life, it's not just about the big decisions, but it's about the small day-to-day decisions as well. So we should hope that tomorrow, Amir Tashem, you know, the Navi tells us, I didn't quote this, but I'll just tell you this outside. The Navi says in number 6, Zechariah says, Ko amar Hashem Tzevakos. Kadosh Baruch Hu said, Tzoma Ravi'i, V'tzoma Chamishi, V'tzoma Shevi, V'tzoma Asiri, Yihye lebeis Yehuda l'sason u'l'simcha l'mo'adin tovim v'emes Hashem lo'evu. That the Navi says, when Mashiach comes and Yeretz Hashem, all of these fast days are going to turn into incredible Yom Tov. And I would suggest that there's the ability to turn Asara B'Teves into a Yom Tov even before Mashiach comes. How can you turn Asara B'Teves into a Yom Tov even before Mashiach comes? Make it into a day of meaning. Make it into a day of growth. Make it into a day, as we said before, where I examine the impact societal influences on my Yiddishkeit and reclaim the purity and the beauty of my Judaism. If I use Asara B'Teves, ultimately, again, as a day where I use it to sensitize myself to the plight and to the difficulties of the other. If I use Asara B'Teves as a day to reflect on the sacrifices of past generations and realize that I am only here because of them. And if I use Asara B'Teves to understand that just like we mark the breach, because the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash did not happen 1-3, but was a result of a series of different events. So if I use Asara B'Teves as a way to sensitize myself to the way I live day to day, not just year by year, but day to day, sensitize myself to the enormity of the small decisions I make because they form a composite and ultimately form the trajectory and nature of my life. If I use Asara B'Teves tomorrow to learn each of these lessons, to assimilate each of these lessons, then even Halavai Mashiach should come tomorrow. But if he doesn't come tomorrow, the day could still be redemptive. And let us hope that in the merit of turning Asara B'Teves into a redemptive day, that in Yiratz Hashem we will be Zocha before the next Asara B'Teves to welcome the Melech HaMashiach.